The term Wall Street is so embedded in our culture as a symbol of corporate and financial power that it draws attention when there's a modifier in front of it. In this case, we'll discuss Occupy Wall Street. It seems like a long time ago now, but it's only been a decade since activists entered the financial district in New York and elsewhere to protest the actions and people who helped trigger a global financial meltdown 3 years earlier. The Occupy movement faded from the scene over time, but is still a topic for discussion today. Heather McKee Hurwitz gives us glimpses of the conduct of the movement from the inside in Are We the 99%? That's a question mark. The Occupy Movement, Feminism and Intersectionality. Heather McKee Hurwitz is a sociologist, feminist scholar, and activist, now working as a visiting researcher at the Cleveland Clinic. Heather, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
It's a pleasure. You were out there with the protesters. Was it to protest, to study, a bit of both?
I wore a few hats. Yes, I was doing research about but I was inspired by women. I was excited for their message about economic equality and democracy. And 10 years ago, almost to the day, because the first encampment started in New York in September 17, and this was a new wave of protest. We've had a lot of protest over the last 10 years, but Occupy really kind of kicked it off. It got people back into the streets again, and I was curious about their message nearly from the start.
How soon after the occupation began in Zuccotti Park in New York City did you get out there?
I started by doing a lot of research online. So I was actually a graduate student in California at the time, a little bit farther south than your listenership. I was in Santa Barbara. But I was watching all of these debates and reports online. Also, I've got to kind of dial your listeners back 10 years ago. Facebook was much newer. Twitter was very new. This was the first movement in the U.S. to really widely use social media, and it was just kind of exploding at that time. And as I watched news reports and started to gather materials for an archive of articles, I noticed this debate happening within the movement. On the one side, people very supportive of the movement's key message, we are the 99%, that idea of bringing so many diverse people together that have a purpose, that have a potential to make change and change life for the vast majority of people, anyone but the 1% most wealthy. And then on the other side, I heard a lot of from experienced racial justice activists, feminists who weren't feeling represented and feel there were a lot of male voices leading things in encampments, and other reports of even some violence happening in some of the major encampments. And so I got extremely curious about how this movement was fulfilling its goals for diversity and inclusion and the ways that there were some issues with that and how we're trying to overcome some of those challenges.
Well, so it's interesting. Essentially, the movement was recreating some of the hierarchies it was set up to oppose.
That is what I found. I spoke with nearly 100 people in depth and then many, many more as I visited events and encampments throughout the end of 2011 as I paid attention to the news reports and got out there in 2012 and met with so many people. There was a real replication of the kind of hierarchies that prioritize the privileged voices in our society. The more privileged voices, the more educated, the more white, the more male, typically these kinds of identities carry along with them a kind of authority. And people are used to seeing leaders who are these kinds of privileged positions. Despite the Occupy movement wanting to be inclusive of all of these different volunteers and the range of people in that 99%, I found that the people who were being heard, being interviewed, taking on the most responsibility and making decisions were those more privileged people, and a kind of informal hierarchy was forming even within the movement.
I want to get this in before a break, which is about a minute away here, but intersectionality is a central concept in the book, and as you use it here, what does it mean?
It's a term that was developed by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, and the idea is we can't just think about someone's relative oppression. One aspect, their class. We have to their racial identity, their gender identity, along with class, along with sexuality, and even other dimensions, really get this more clear of how relatively privileged or relatively oppressed.
All right, Heather, we're going to hang up on you and call you right back because we have a little cell phone fade that's coming in and out, but we'll call you right back, and so we'll get you back before we get to the next segment. So to restate intersectionality, I mean, it indicates that there are other things going on. People have you know, they belong to several groups at once potentially. Is that right, Heather?
That's a way to look at it, definitely. People might encounter multiple kinds of oppressions at the same time because there are someone who's queer and a person of color and feminine, these various dimensions carry their own kinds of oppressions with them. If we only thought about one dimension of a person, how economically well off they are, we're probably going to miss a lot of the kinds of pressures in their life.
So were there responses to the issues that people were raising? You were pointing out that you got interested in reading on social media and elsewhere about the fact that there were people saying, hey, look, you know, we got the people with the college degrees and the white guys tending to step up in the movement and start acting like leaders, which is not exactly the idea. Did things change in response to observations like those?
They did for some groups within the movement. So this was an amorphous, voluntary, you know, anyone could show up in your town square and participate and even take on responsibility. So there were some people who kind of stepped up and said, you know, we need a separate place for women and queer people to really feel safe and heard within the encampment, and they made separate sections of the protest, specifically for people to really have a voice. And there were also activists, like racial justice activists, who said, you know, recession is impacting people of color disproportionately. Even if the movement isn't bringing in that part of the analysis, class and race analysis together, we're going to have a people of color working group, and that message that we're going to put out. And they did.
Was that enough, though? I mean, were they essentially providing different spaces? I mean, were they segregating in some ways?
You're right that it did segregate the movement. It took some of the energy away from those main movement groups to have these kind of almost little protest groups within the movement. I mean, it was also very vibrant. It was exciting to have these messages and to have people learn about intersectionality by coming to the encampment, to be exposed to feminism in the course of protesting for the Occupy movement. But as I analyze in the book, if a main movement does not address these kinds of really deep tensions, eventually, it's going to pull the membership away from the movement, and there will be splits. And that was really one of the reasons that Occupy faded to some degree. People went off to work on the issues that were important to them, and that main central movement didn't incorporate these critiques comprehensively.
Well, the idea of having 99% of the people together on something is kind of a rare concept in itself. What can you tell us, Heather, about the creation of the term, the 99%?
Oh, it's tough. And I commend the movement for trying it, for bringing that idea of the 99 versus the 1% to our national conversation. This is a way of thinking about inequality that wasn't on the scene 10 years ago and has really transformed a national conversation about inequality. There's a lot more discussion about economic inequality. And, you know, we even saw the Bernie Sanders campaign keep using this through two presidential campaigns. It was really a driving message of we need to fight for the 1%. We can tax the 1%. You know, we can reform these most wealthy persons throughout our country, and that's a real way to bring more economic equality.
Heather McKee Hurwitz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Are We the 99%? The Occupy Movement, Feminism, and Intersectionality. How galvanizing, Heather, did you find the term to be? How much of a beacon to bring in other people and attract them to the movement?
There were many people who I met who that was such an important message for them, because a movement based around class issues hadn't really been a central focus, and a movement in the streets to really critique Wall Street and bring about really substantive critiques of the failings of the mortgage industry, the lack of regulation on Wall Street, the need for greater employment and to deal with the high unemployment issues that had been plaguing the U.S. and around the world since the financial crisis began in 2007 and 2008. And so it was a very attractive message. I think that if the movement had had that more intersectional analysis that some movements have had since then, I think intersectionality has really been a foundation of the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. And I think that's where some of that tension came in, and people got interested in the 99%, but then they said, like the title of the book, are we really the 99%? You know, are we really thinking about me, where I've been through so much racial discrimination? Am I really part of this 99% idea? And so those tensions really came out in the movement. There were a lot of debates about that idea.
All right, so let's talk about some of the terms and practices used in the Occupy movements at Occupy Wall Street first, and then at other Occupy encampments around the country. General assemblies and mic checks are the two terms I'm thinking about first.
Yes. General assemblies were these large group meetings, kind of like a town hall, where people gathered in the town square and anyone could participate in this giant meeting. People were using a variety of processes, often called consensus decision-making. It's a technical term, but it's just a way that big groups can make decisions together. And so they met there, and if someone wanted to speak, they could just say, mic check. And people around them would hear them and also say, mic check, and start repeating what the original person had said. It was a kind of call and response chant that became a way to amplify people's voices, even if they didn't have an electronic system for doing so, or microphones or bullhorns. And it was an attempt to really hear everyone, however they could speak up.
Were those supposed, I mean, in some cases, as you point out, they didn't want to get their amplifiers confiscated by police, so it began in that sense, but were they supposed to indicate solidarity too? I mean, would you repeat the things that you agreed with and the idea that we're all together in this?
It was a way to create solidarity. It was, when you were doing it, you know, you were speaking other people's words. You had to really listen. You had to help someone else be heard in that moment. And it was a way to bring people together. It was almost like singing in a way, where there was this group solidarity to really try to hear each other and hear each other out. So it was a really positive attempt. if you were loud enough. So that's kind of where the mic check broke down a little bit. If you weren't the loudest person, if you didn't feel like kind of screaming your ideas or didn't feel comfortable speaking in front of a big group for whatever reason, then maybe the mic check didn't really work for you.
So where were the places where people who didn't feel like speaking in front of people or had concerns that didn't want to participate in the mic check in that way? Or, I mean, obviously the General Assembly was not the place to conduct some of the business, but then was that part of the complication of Occupy Wall Street? I mean, we're supposed to be doing all this together, but then we also have to have private conversations and talk about things we want to do.
So there was just a real variety of approaches to making decisions. Sometimes there were small groups that broke out where they had depth discussions. Part of a real lesson, I think, learned from Occupy, though, is that there was not a consistent structure or training around the country that could spread to these different encampments about how to do it in a really inclusive way. So it was up to the people leading that particular meeting in that particular encampment how much they were going to hear from the various people involved. Were they even going to create some kind of a breakout group where small groups?
Oh, I think the phone will come back at some point. Heather, we lost you for a second. Okay, more than a second. Okay, we're going to call Heather back again. I'm not sure what the deal is with the phone on that end, but here we go. We are on the Jefferson Exchange with Heather McKee Hurwitz. Her book is Are We the 99%? The Occupy Movement, Feminism, and Intersectionality. You can take part in the conversation. I am confident it will resume. 800-838-3760 on the phone. 800-838-3760 is our phone number. You can call that any place on the planet, I would think. And also email us from any place on the planet, jx@jeffnet.org. If you're wondering about Heather's role, she wore multiple hats, as she's told us, at the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Oakland and other encampments in the Bay Area as well, and also attended a national gathering of the folks at Occupy. So that's the places that she saw the movement, and yes, went out there as both a sociologist, feminist scholar, and activist. So had a couple of hats to wear. She describes the situation as passionate detachment. So back on the Jefferson Exchange with Heather McKee Hurwitz, and are we the 99%? And so Heather, we have a email here from Daniel in Eugene who picks up on you mentioning that Occupy's communication was via the earlier social media platforms, Facebook, Google, Twitter, etc., but points out that the police were also monitoring that communication and used it to coordinate their actions across the nation with simultaneously arrests and camp breakups, etc. Looking ahead, how can a movement avoid the tracking by police since even a higher percentage of people now carry tracking devices, a.k.a. cell phones? Thank you, says Daniel in Eugene.
It's a really pressing concern, Daniel, and I think it's a great question. In those early days, activists were, I think, so excited to use Twitter. I mean, they were doing Twitter workshops in the encampments to teach each other how to use it, but absolutely these public social media threads could be easily monitored, and eventually activists evolved to using some other kinds of more secure text messaging loops or more secure channels or other kinds of more encrypted social media. So that's something for activists to look into. But always there's the issue of if someone who is against the movement or police who want to monitor the movement to keep them off of those channels is something I think technology can't really help. It's a people matter to be really careful about what activists you're working with.
So to come a little closer into the material here, because you did interview, as you pointed out, nearly 100 people in depth here, and mm-hmm. So you have some names attached to some of the comments of the book, and Vilma, for example, at Occupy Oakland talks about Latinos in the movement and how don't even think about them as like a clump of people who all think the same way.
That's right. There was, as she said, you know, people were so excited. There was this whole group of Spanish speakers, but there are a real difference between people who, let's say, are born and live in Puerto Rico for most of their lives, or who are second generation and grow up in the U.S. There are different concerns among and within groups of Latino people, and this kind of diversity within the diversity was a challenge. It was a kind of unfortunate challenge, I think, for a lot of people of color, especially those who have been racial justice activists or activists with other Latino people for so long. Of course, there are so many different issues among Latino populations that were, they felt in many ways kind of glossed over a little bit by the movement overall. And there was really a need to hear those specific voices and stories and not do that glossing over. Some people really kind of pulled away from the movement if they felt, you know, my particular experiences are not really being appreciated in this 99% kind of catch-all idea.
As a woman yourself, did you experience some sexism or even harassment at the various sites? And as I pointed out, as we were getting you reconnected, that you your presence at Occupy was both in New York City and the Bay Area, and also at a national gathering.
That's right. I went to the movements that were really the most prominent in the news and were making waves that smaller encampments paid attention to around the country. So the book is focused on those kind of larger spaces and doesn't get into the details about, you know, everything happening in Eugene or Portland or even Sacramento, even though there were really important encampments in many other places, in Oregon, California, and other places. And I did feel some sense of unease in the encampments. I was invited into a tent or two with other activists, I think as a kind of pickup line to some degree. That was one element of the Occupy movement, some, you know, people looking to find other people to date or be with. But the problem there is that, you know, I was there as a researcher and an activist, as were many other people. And to kind of not start with that and not respect someone as a full-fledged, you know, human being, but kind of just go right to that kind of sexual dimension was problematic. And a number of feminist groups called this out.
And with the whole idea of passionate detachment, though, how we're, and we're coming up to a break here, so you'll have to ask for a short answer here, but how were you able to, like, take part in, at some point? And did you, like, allocate your time in blocks of time for the day or something to observe versus take part?
I was always doing both. I was taking a lot of notes. Some people thought I was a journalist. And then I went home and I digested those notes and kind of stood back and did a lot of reflections.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking just a little bit about sexism in the movement here, and also about social media use and how forward the folks at Occupy were. But then you got a melding of those two with things like the hot chicks of Occupy Wall Street. What was that?
That was a video that a couple of supporters made, and it featured many of the women who were participating, but often focused on their chest or tried to highlight them like they were their beauty and not so much hear their words. Perhaps even more problematic was a website that went along with the video where people could vote for their favorite woman activist. And this was allowed in the movement. So again, free, voluntary, anyone could post a video to support the movement. And I would expect that perhaps many heterosexual men liked what they saw and came down to the encampment. But at the same time, it really undermined the women who were contributing to the encampment and portrayed them more like objects.
Well, yeah, certainly that. I see that it was an attempt to talk to the world about the movement. And in general, did you think there was enough about that, or was much of the communication about trying to bring in more people rather than try to publicize the cause? Or were they just one and the same?
You know, I can't speak for the filmmakers themselves. In a response to some of these feminist critiques of the video, they said, you know, any kind of video that creates dialogue about the Occupy movement is good. Any kind of debate about issues about women and their representation, isn't that a good thing? Well, yes, it sparks conversation and dialogue, and I think solidified some of the feminists who were both contributing to Occupy, but critiquing the movement and wanting to steer it in a way to really be more inclusive. And at the same time, I would say that not every social media video is good. Not all publicity for a movement is good publicity. And one of the lessons to be learned from Occupy is that movements should have a more centralized and organized hub of people who are taking stock of the kind of media messages coming out of the movement. It's hard to do because we have social media and there's a lot of citizen journalism, but some of those messages, like the hot chicks, turned off segments of activists who probably would have been interested in the 99% idea otherwise.
Do you think that the 99% idea is just too broad? I mean, at some point you're going to have groups getting annoyed that their needs aren't being met. And as you point out, some of them began to break away. And yes, it might have helped to have central leadership, but do you have A, an unwieldy coalition to begin with, and then B, people who really don't want to go with the hierarchy anyway, but you might actually need one to hold things together?
It is too broad if we don't have that analysis that's based on intersectionality, and if we don't really hear the specific stories of people who are part of that 99%, and if that 99%, like in the case of the Occupy movement, became so focused on the class and economic message that it was difficult to bring in groups who had long been working on other and complementary issues, such as those in LGBTQ movements or racial justice activists. There wasn't a focus on that coalition building as a real substantial part of building a 99% movement. I do think that a big tent, progressive social movement is an exciting idea. I think that there have been mass diverse movements in our country, and Occupy made a good attempt at trying to do it. There are just lessons we need to learn and some changes, like making intersectionality much more prominent, that may create a different kind of big tent movement in the future.
Let's take a phone call here. Skeeter in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Heather McKee Hurwitz, author of Are We the 99%?
Hiya.
Hi.
Thank you for a great program. I really appreciate your reflections based on your experiences and your involvement with Occupy 10 years ago. Wow. I'm curious if you might offer any suggestions on where we go from here. We sure have all the problems still. And one recommendation that I might make based on experiences doing anti-nuke work back with bunches, hundreds of people in the mid and late 70s, we used affinity groups when we were doing nonviolent direct action civil disobedience against the Trojan plan. And that was our way of organizing small groups of 7 to about 15 people who friends who knew each other, and it was hard to get infiltrated that way. but I'm thinking, where do we go from here? We want to fix the world, and we've got lots of energies right now, and yeah. Do you have any suggestions? And thank you so much.
All right, Skeeter, thanks for that. Just a reminder to our audience, if the term doesn't ring familiar, Trojan was the only nuclear power plant in Oregon shut down in the 90s. So go ahead, Heather. What do you think about what Skeeter was asking?
Well, thanks for your comments, Skeeter, and for your work with the anti-nuclear movement. The anti-nuclear movement and the ways that it was organized were part of the inspiration for the Occupy movement. And I think people were advocating affinity groups and the kind of consensus process that the anti-nuclear movement had used. But there were also a lot of new young activists that maybe didn't get fully that idea and had other ways of thinking about organizing. So, you know, it was a challenging time because even you had a different mix of experienced activists and a different mix of people of different ages coming together. So those were some of the challenges for Occupy. I think if a future movement needs to be a lot more upfront about that there are those differences within the movement, and I would really advocate a more of a leadership structure. I think that was one of the ways that the Occupy movement kind of harmed itself, because it was all voluntary. Whoever wanted to take responsibility, there wasn't a way to really rotate leadership, let alone a consistent way to rotate who spoke and who was heard during meetings. At some point, some groups used the step up, step back technique, which was a real conscious effort for those people who, you know, hadn't spoken during the meeting or who maybe typically don't, let's say because they're less educated or don't feel like their voice as a person of color matters as much. Well, there were forces within the movement to try to reverse that and really employ hearing from everyone. This step up, step back technique, I think, is something for also for future movements to use. And that might bring people together more and create that more inclusive feel so that people feel like they don't have to break away into subgroups. That kind of separation that happened in Occupy is something for future movements to really be conscious of. And if there are major tensions, address those tensions. Don't let them just go into this subgroups.
Should, you know, given the leadership vacuum that you describe here, I mean, what would have been an appropriate way and perhaps will be in the future for a group to decide how to pick leaders even?
We need a real conversation about what it is to be a leader. And I think we need more learning about relational leadership. Again, I learned this from the Occupy movement. They really wanted many of the followers to take a real responsibility and be part of leadership decisions in a much more collaborative and team-based kind of way. So there's not that separation between leaders and followers. But I don't think that our leadership conversation is really there in this country. I think that idea of followers or participants being very informed, having a lot of responsibility, not just following along, being an active part, and leaders taking into account the range of people's views and voices, and that reflective process as well that happens in a close relationship. I mean, that's just one way that we need to think about leadership differently, and I think that's a real starting point. We need to appreciate diverse leadership in ways that we're really just starting to over the last, you know, 5-10 years with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think there's been a shift to wanting more diverse leadership, even beyond movements, in a range of organizations. I think that could transform our movements in the future.
You know, a lot of eyes, including my own at the time, took in the sights of Occupy Wall Street and the other Occupy encampments and thought, well, this is like a counterweight to the Tea Party movement of just a year earlier. But it ended up with nothing like the political and staying power. And the question I haven't thought to ask until now is, did anybody really want that for the Occupy movement within the movement?
It was not as focused when the Occupy movement was in the encampments on that political involvement in government. It was really a protest movement pushing on external or extra institutional means to create change. But I think about the Bernie Sanders moment when, you know, just a few years later, you had many Occupy activists who got behind the Bernie campaign. They really lit up the social media networks that Occupy had developed to push for Bernie Sanders as a, maybe not an Occupy representative, but someone who was really advocating very similar ideas as the Occupy movement. And it became a really massive movement and a push within the national government. And I think we have even seen the Biden administration needing to respond to that. So it wasn't the same pathway as the Tea Party, but there were definitely forces that really pushed on the broad national government that kind of started in the Occupy movement and have gone that way to some degree.
So the ideas have continued to percolate through society, you're saying, and even getting some embracing by people in positions of power to do something about implementing them.
Oh, absolutely. This movement, even though it kind of faded from the news media in 2012-ish, the movement transformed and has continued in variety of other activist groups and government groups and groups putting out policy statements, groups working to transform labor rights, working in new kinds of configurations, maybe under a new name, but a lot of those activists met at the Occupy movement and have continued to seek political changes.
All right, so there is indeed a legacy there.
Definitely.
All right, Heather McKee Hurwitz is a sociologist, feminist scholar, and activist who visited Occupy encampments in New York City and the Bay Area and at a national gathering, both as activist and as documenter, and came up with the book, Are We the 99%? That's a question mark. Are we the 99%? The Occupy Movement, Feminism, and Intersectionality. Heather, thank you so much for sharing this with us on The Exchange today.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right, take care.